My apologies for being late. I would love to blame the rain or the traffic, but I can't. It's like that I was on time before is a date to circle in your calendar. It's real hard for me. I think because I don't have a good sense of time, and I always think, oh, I have time to do that, but I don't. And I'll have to say this, tomorrow evening is the Conservancy for the Parthenon and Centennial Park's annual gala, and so there were a couple of little crises at work that had to have attention before I could leave. So, and I was, I got in early this morning and started adding stuff to the PowerPoint. So, instead of finishing that yesterday. So, today we start with the Centennial Exposition, which took place as a celebration of Tennessee's first 100 years of statehood from May through October of 1897. Now, those of you who are up to date on your Tennessee history know that that's not the anniversary date. Tennessee was admitted to the Union in 1796. But there was a financial crisis, a little mini recession in the late 90s, and there was a really divisive political situation, and I'm not sure actually whether that was local or national, but at any rate, the planners felt like they could not get it together to happen on the anniversary date. So it happened a year later. So those of us who are celebrating anniversary have two different years we can celebrate. It was an event that all parts of Tennessee participated in, and you just name a subject where Tennessee wanted to toot its horn, and there was a building for it or an exhibit for it, and I want, just like for the ancient Parthenon, I want a time machine so badly. I want to go see what it all looked like in color and with people wandering around. And since science hasn't yet come up with that, we are forced to experience it through some really pretty wonderful photographs. Let me interrupt myself here to say a couple of things so that I don't forget at the end of class. So much of the work that is done to understand ancient cultures is funded by and for various archaeological societies in various countries. The American one is called the American Institute for Archaeology, or I'm not sure if it's of or for archaeology. They support archaeological digs all across the world. They support with scholarships students who are studying to go into archaeology, whether that's classical European, like Greece and Rome, or Near Eastern, or Far Eastern, or African, all of those places have information, much of it underground, some of it just partly above ground, that can inform us about our heritage, all of us. So I say that to encourage membership in the Archaeological Institute of America, and that's what it is. I said it backwards before. And to encourage you to support the Conservancy for the Parthenon and Centennial Park, because that nonprofit entity is what supports our programming and enables us to do the educational exhibition programs that we do. The City of Nashville owns the building, pays the staff. But we couldn't do program if it weren't for this Conservancy. Today I brought some copies of Archaeology magazine for you to look at. I've counted them. I will go home with the same number, please, that I brought. It is a wonderful magazine that comes with your membership in the AIA, and it's written for those of us who are lay people, who are interested but not scholars in the discipline. And there's always information about subjects in the Mediterranean area, as well as North America, Europe, the Far East, every place you could think of, and it's just fascinating to find out what's going on. And right now they're running a sale on membership, and so I brought a couple of little coupons if you want to join, and you can just tear one off. They're three, and if you want to join and somebody's already got all three of those, let me know and I'll send you something. I also brought the poster and press release for the symposium that's happening at the Parthenon on Tuesday night, because I mentioned that last week to you all, and Amy's going to send out an email about it. But there, I've got four that if you're particularly interested or want to share it with somebody else, you can pick up today before you leave. I think that's all the commercials that I need to do. One other thing about before we completely leave, this is not a commercial, but before we completely leave antiquity, I wanted to say something that I forgot last week. One of the reasons, you know, we talked about the fire that happened to the Parthenon in the 3rd century, about 267 AD. It was so devastating, and they rebuilt. They never put the roof back on the porch, but they did rebuild. And evidently, that fire was so hot that it, even though the marble didn't burn, it cracked with that those thermal, the intense heat. And Manolis Kares, who was the architect for 30 years for the restoration to the Parthenon, believes that the explosion of 1687 would not have been nearly so devastating had it not been for that fire 1,200 years before, 1,400 years before, that he can look at the marble that's broken, and there is a difference in percussive cracks and thermal cracks. Thermal cracks tend to have curves. Percussive cracks are straight line. So he can look at the marble and see how it broke and know that it was simply from the force of the explosion, or it was stone that had been weakened by thermal cracks beforehand. So it's just interesting to note how something that looks as though it did no harm or did little harm could be repaired had an effect more than 1,400 years later. Okay, now we're back to 1897. This is a photograph taken during the exposition. So you see people wandering around, but it's not the rest of the fair is invisible. One of the things that I brought and put on an easel here that you might want to look at later, or maybe we'll take a break at some point, is a aerial layout. It really helps. We're going to look at a lot of these buildings, but it helps greatly to get in your mind where things are, looking at them overhead. Before it was the grounds for the exposition, the area that is now Centennial Park was West Side Racetrack. Before that had been the state fairgrounds. But the fairgrounds had moved. It had become a horse racing track, and that was the spot that the planners thought would be the easiest to build in, the most accessible to the most people. So they chose this. And this shows you the grade back, screened back layout is an aerial view of today. So we've got the Parthenon's right here. Here's West End. That hasn't changed. McDonald's is right here. It's a landmark. The railroad tracks are still exactly where they were. So Charlotte Avenue is back here, and this is that little, it comes in now like this, and the HCA buildings are along here. So that, and here are, this is the track, the grandstands, the stables, etc. So it was, and I've forgotten this was on here, from 1884 to 1895 is when it was the racetrack. And it closed in 1893 so they could start building. This is an aerial view of the exposition itself, laid over the same photograph of today. So we have the Parthenon, which hasn't moved. West End still out here. And the dotted red line is today's Centennial Park. So it goes all the way over. This is Flagpole Hill. And now Dog Park Hill, and the what used to be the Oman Construction Company is now the Parks Department's administrative office and maintenance barn for the whole west part of the county. The entrance to the fair was here, right off of, well, where the funeral home is now. And, well, right behind it anyway. So I think this is probably the entrance gate. And there's a road still that goes into Centennial Park right there. If you're familiar with it, there's the there's a little concrete bridge. And it's not clear to me, I've never found out for sure, whether that concrete bridge was part of the exposition or came after. There was a little lake, as you can see from the blue on this map. This is Lake Watauga. This is the big lake that... Big lake. Well, sometimes when I am talking to people in the Parthenon and I say, well, it's right out there by the lake. And they say, lake? Oh, you mean that pond? Oh, yeah, okay. Well, it's a lake. Lake Watauga. What is now the Sunken Garden was, at the time of the exposition, Lily Lake. Down in the front, right behind this little cutout in the red line right there, that's the funeral home. So right behind the funeral home, in that really beautiful but underused area of the park, I think, it's sort of dipped down, it's covered in trees. That was Lake Catherine at the time of the exposition.
Is there like a shell?
The shell is right there, that's right. And it marks a spring. Now, the spring hasn't been open for years and is not now, and that concrete shell is in terrible shape. It's fenced off. So it's part of the plan to get that revived.
They've opened the spring.
Cockrell Spring, which is down here. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if this, where the shell was piped from Cockrell Spring or whether it was another spring. I've never found that out, but I hope that they'll repair that concrete shell and make the spring a water feature again. The early version of the new master plan had a little lake there. I think that the technical difficulties of moving a culvert and part of the Nashville sewer system may be too great to ever make that a lake again, but they will do something beautiful to that area, and I hope let the shell spring work again. There was over where there are hospitals now, or maybe those are the tennis courts, probably the tennis courts, there was Lake Sevier. So water was a big feature of the exposition, and it must have been just beautiful. This is, unfortunately, there's not exactly the same height for this picture, but this is roughly today. Now, there's been some changes recently, but you can see that the lake is still in position, so is the Parthenon, and all of this area was just covered with buildings, and the actual Centennial grounds extended back to the railroad, so the HTA buildings were actually part of the exposition. Vanity Fair, which we're going to talk about, was right here. This is... This is 31st, I believe, or maybe that's 29th, and 31st is out of the picture over here. I think that's right. As you can see, McDonald's has its place there. Do any of you remember when that was a little, when that actual corner was the Natchez Trace restaurant, was a meat and three?
Yeah, the most wonderful French coconut pie.
Oh, don't tell me that. It's gone, and it's been gone for, 30 years?
Pico Needham shrimp.
Did they have people? Wow.
Nice.
It was nice. And there was a row of little shops along there. And the fabric of Nashville has changed over the past 40 years. And dear Gussie, hold on to your hat because it's changing faster than we can see today. Okay, this is the main entrance to the exposition. As I said, it is that road. It was right over the road where you can enter the park now behind the funeral home. And you see, I don't know if you can see it very well with this slide, but there's a little Athena sitting on top of it right there. This was the admission booth. And I think admission was 25 cents or 25 cents. And most of the rides were a dime, which, of course, was a lot more money then than it is now. There was entertainment and education, but really the purpose of the fair was to say, hey, look at us, beautiful state, progressive state. You probably want your business here. You might want to move here. You might want to visit. People opened their houses with extra rooms. I mean, you know, they did boarding house stuff so that people would have a place to stay. There were because there weren't many hotels in Nashville. The population of Nashville at this time was under 100,000 people. So it was a thriving but small city. We're going to come back to this photograph in a minute because there's something else to see in this. And all the buildings were outlined in electric lights. And if you think about 1897, this is before every home had electricity. Some houses, most houses had gas light. Some probably had converted to part gas, part electric. Some businesses had electricity, maybe most, I don't know. But certainly not everybody had electricity. And to come to the fair and be there at night and see all those buildings outlined must have been just like a fairyland. As I said, the population of Nashville was under 100,000, and in this six-month period, almost 2 million people visited the fair. Now, I understand that some of those would have been repeat visitors, but still, that's a lot of folks. The railroads were huge supporters and underwriters of the expense. I mean, there was quite a bit of argument, I think, in the state legislature about exactly how much, were they actually going to do this fair? It was an era of fairs, so it wasn't an out-of-the-box kind of thing to do. I mean, the Chicago Fair in 1893 had been a huge success, but it had also cost a lot of money. There had been the Cotton States Exposition in Atlanta in 1895. There would be a World's Fair in St. Louis in 1904 or 5. It all began, I think, with the one in London in the 1850s that had the Crystal Palace and was a huge thing. The Paris World's Fair, for which the Eiffel Tower was created, was sometime in there. The Nation did a big World's Fair to celebrate our independence in 1876. So this is a time period when this provided what public television does for us today, education and entertainment at the same time. And it generated funds. It was a great economic engine for the region, for the city or the state or the general region, because people traveled to come here. Anybody who was within reach and could afford it. But their leisure time and dollar were limited. So a day at the fair was a great big deal. This particular view has, you can't see it, but the Parthenon is out of sight over here, as well as the Memphis building. This is one edge of the Commerce building. You can see some of the midway here, and we'll talk about those individual things. This is the north sort of leg of Lake Watauga. Nashville, as a city, decided to contribute the art building for the exposition. I mean, there was, as I said, you name a subject where Tennessee wanted to say, look at us, we're good, and there was a building for it. They wanted to say what a cultured city Nashville is. We are, after all, the Athens of the South. And so the art building seemed appropriate. They borrowed almost 1,200 works of art, with an emphasis on American art, but it wasn't exclusively American art, and built the art building as a copy of the Parthenon to remind everybody of this nickname. It was a great statement for the city to make about itself.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
So we were the Athens of the South before we got
the
Parthenon?
The Parthenon, yes, is as a result of that nickname. So the nickname... The other way around. And I think there's a good deal of confusion about that, but the nickname existed from prior to 1850. When Philip Lindsley died, he is the man who was the acting president of Princeton in the 1700s, early 1800s, and when Nashville felt physically secure as a town, they applied to the state legislature, and at this time, let me think about this. No, they were already a state. wanted to found a university, and it became the University of Nashville, and the descendant of that, with lots of little distracting paths and bends, is Peabody College of Education, that's part of Vanderbilt now. But they invited Philip Lindsley to come, to leave Princeton and become the president of this new university. And he did. I think, I can't remember how many children under 10 he and his wife had, and they came in a covered wagon over the mountains. I just can't imagine. But their family, the Lindsley family, settled in Nashville and were always big educators. His daughter, I think I'm right about this, was big on Sunday schools and teaching children that way. And that originated not particularly as religious education, but as a way to educate laborers who had no other day off except Sunday, and to educate their children. So Sunday schools originally were both about religion, but more important about education. And it was his daughter, whose first name I can't remember now, who helped start that in Nashville. Anyway, when Philip Lindsley died, his family was prominent in education circles in Nashville, and someone who was speaking a eulogy about him said, if anyone is responsible for Nashville's being the Athens of the West, it would be Philip Lindsley. And you see, we were West at that time. Now, of course, by the time you get just 50 years later, in 1897, the country has moved much farther west. We've had a huge civil war, and so we're the South by that point. But that would have been 1840-something. So evidently, exactly who originated that term the first time is lost in the mists of time, but it was common enough for that man to say about Philip Lindsley, and make reference to the Athens of the West. So to take advantage of and to increase that nickname, Nashville's contribution was the Parthenon. Now, inside, it was a series of galleries. It was not a recreation of the ancient Parthenon for 1897. It was a series of sort of sectioned off galleries like this. And you can see that there were paintings by American artists, loan collections, foreign paintings, and they are grouped by where the paintings came from. I mean, where the artists came from. This is what it looked like. I tell you, I'm grateful that this is out of style. This is called salon style hanging, and it was in vogue. It was the way to do it. And actually, I believe the Renwick Gallery in Washington has a couple of galleries that are set up like this. So you sit on those tufted round things and look at the art all around you. But it's not only difficult to hang like this, it's, I think, difficult to view the art this way. You see it in an aggregate, but it's really hard to look at a single painting. There's just so much busyness going on. We have done it at the Parthenon in recent years a couple of times in a small way, just to show people what it might look like if you were to stumble on it in person. And I'm not sure how high they are hung, but that's pretty high. That's like, it's not all the way to the ceiling, but it's probably 14, 15 feet high? I don't know. The Athena, she was necessary, of course. This was her house. But she was outside because the inside was all taken up with salon-style hanging art. The sculptor was Enid Yandell. She lived in Kentucky, but she had Nashville ties. Her mother was in Elliston. So if you know Elliston Place, I think that's that family. She was working and studying in Paris at the time, and this, at the time, was the largest commission statue by a woman artist ever. And the story is told, and actually I've seen a newspaper picture that's pretty interesting. She, but the night before she crated up the pieces to ship to the U.S., she served four friends dinner in the shoulders. So it was pretty big. So that's actually the whole thing from the ground up is close to the same height as the statue inside the Parthenon now. I think it's 40 feet rather than 42, but you see how much of it is base as opposed to figure. As I said earlier, the railroads were huge pushers of this exposition. It was to their advantage because so many people were going to ride the rails in. So they even sent advertising cars like this out to the highways and the byways to invite people in. So it advertised that it also brought people in. I mean, literally, they came on this car. The NC and St. L, Nashville, Chattanooga, and St. Louis was probably the biggest rail line through here, but there was also the other one that that Jerry Baxter was president of, and I can't remember what that was called. Tennessee Railway?
Tennessee Central.
Tennessee Central, that's it. And so they were rivals. John Thomas was the president of the NC and St. L, and he became the president of the Centennial Exposition. He knew that that was going to be his position. I mean, I guess he was the group that organized the exposition formed probably by about 1893, and John Thomas was asked to be president. So he spent a lot of time looking at other fairs and getting good ideas and deciding how he was going to make this successful. Generally speaking, these fairs did provide an economic engine for the region, but they themselves, the fairs, usually lost money. It was kind of, I mean, it's a loss leader. It was bring people in, get them to spend their money, help our tax base, but the fairs themselves were not expected to make money. John Thomas kind of thought they should. So he was a very savvy promoter and president. And one of the tricks was, of course, to send out the rail car that advertised it, and you could get on the advertising car and ride in. There was a spur line that actually came into the grounds of the exposition, and people who came in that way, as opposed to the entrance we looked at a few minutes ago, got off in this building. It was just like it was a railway station. And of course, inside, not only were there was there the railway, but there were also exhibitions, probably about this particular rail line, because it was a separate transportation building. The contribution from the city of Memphis was this, and Shelby County together, was this pyramid to remind, it's called the Pyramid of Cheops. It doesn't, I mean, it's modified somewhat. I don't think the Pyramid of Cheops had this, had this little portico here on all four sides. But they wanted people to remember that they were named for Memphis, Egypt, and that all of this, all this classical influence, whether it's from classical Greece and Rome or from even earlier civilizations, it was a way to say, we're cultured, we're civilized like these civilizations that we study and admire. You can see here in this picture, there's a corner of the Parthenon here and the Commerce Building back here. Knoxville also contributed a building. And Chattanooga had a giant display inside the Minerals and Forestry Building. And other cities, there was, in the Woman's Building, the ladies of various cities took rooms to decorate. And so various cities in Tennessee participated in different ways. I think Nashville, Memphis, and Knoxville were the three biggies in terms of actually having a building that was theirs. Was that a hand? Oh, okay. It's really odd to me that the Chattanooga's display in the Minerals and Forestry Building was a recreation of Anne Hathaway's cottage. I don't know why, but anyway, there was. The Commerce Building was the largest building at the fair, and if you think about that, That is totally logical. It was, come on, let's do commerce. Let's trade. You spend your money here. We'll ship our goods there. It was very, very important to the fair. And so it should be no surprise that it is the biggest. There on the top of the pediment, the portico that leads you in, is a figure of Hermes or Mercury, and there he is again, who was the god of commerce in antiquity. I mean, that's, and interestingly, the god of thieves. Anyway, those of you who've lived here for a very long time might remember that after the fair, this little statue, it was copper, was placed on top of the clock tower of Union Station, which was brand new at the time. And it was there until the mid-50s, I understand. And there was a really bad storm that knocked it down. And that fall, because I'm not sure how tall that tower is, but copper is a fairly soft metal, and I think it was just smooshed. And so the clock tower was for decades without anything on top of it. And then I don't know who it was who commissioned Alan LaQuire to make something. And it's not a statue in the three-dimensional round. It's flat with, but anyway, it has the same effect. Who's going to know from down where we are? Here's the Minerals and Forestry Building. It was pretty big, too. And so anything that, like mining or logging, anything that was available in Tennessee to be shipped out or where people could make money here was being sold. I don't mean physically sold at the fair, but the idea of this is a place you could bring your business. Probably the industries that were advertising in them. I mean, I would guess, and that's a good question, I don't really know, if there was an area of Tennessee where there was big mining or big logging or where they were producing big machines, those areas of the state or those industries themselves were likely the ones who built the buildings and then exhibited their stuff. Yeah?
Are all these buildings made of wood?
The stuff I read about it indicates they had to last at least 6 months, and most of them were under construction for a couple of years before the fair actually opened. So they are wood and then lath and plaster over that, probably on a stone foundation. Not sure about the foundations, but they had to be fairly sturdy. They were going to get traffic of 2 million people. Mm-mm. All disposable material. It is unclear, actually, whether the Parthenon was intended to last beyond the fair or not. It's possible that it was up for demolition also. All of these buildings were designed to be torn down at the end of the fair, and the land was going to be sold and subdivided for residential development. So that was the plan. Not what happened, thank goodness. So Machinery Hall would have held big machines, things that were developed here or available in Tennessee or used for something in Tennessee so that people would think, oh, wow. But it also, each of these not only had the commercial aspect, but the educational aspect. They were showing off new versions of machines or new inventions, ways to do things that were educational for the people who came. So it wasn't strictly commercial. That was a big, big piece underlying everything. But it was also designed to be, you know, the Epcot Center of its day. It was a way to say, oh, I learned something today. And for families to come, for parents to bring their children so that they got something to take away with them as far as progress. So it was also, progress was a huge thing. Tennessee wanted to say, not only are we a beautiful state, not only do we have great natural resources and really friendly people, but we are progressive. Think about this being only 30 years after the end of the Civil War, when the South was devastated. Nashville was an occupied city for most of the war, so it had less physical damage than some, but it was not an easy time post-Civil War. Definitely. And I'm glad you pointed that out. It was all classical design. I mean, you see domes, some, lots of pediments with columns. They'd taken a leaf out of the book of the Columbian Exposition from 1893, which was very much this way too, the White City. And which brings up another thing. They did incorporate as a city with a mayor and a little police force because various the Gerst beer family, the brewery, and others wanted to be able to sell liquor, to serve beer with at the restaurants and stuff, and Nashville was a dry town. And each city, county within the state could make that decision independently. So the organizers of the fair said to the state legislature, we want to be able to, I mean, the Gersts are going to build a couple of restaurants. We need to, for them to be, they're not going to do it if they can't sell their beer. And the state legislature said, in effect, not touching that. You can incorporate as a city and make your own decision. So that's what they did. So, yes, you're right to pick up on the classical look. It was deliberate. And it's once again that tie back to the to antiquity and a way of saying balanced, orderly, beautiful way of building buildings reflects how we are. We are civilized, we are organized, we're beautiful, we are classical. So it was on purpose. We have the hygiene and education building. So even though all the buildings were supposed to provide some educational input, this one was dedicated to that. The children's building, which I think might have been pink and white. It looks like a wedding cake here, and I love it. And here again, I'm glad you pointed out that we don't have a classical form exactly, but there are the columns. What kind are they, ladies and gentlemen? I think they're Ionic. Maybe I'm looking at them wrong. Don't they have the scroll? Okay, they're Ionic. And they also have, this building has a pediment, not sitting right on top of the architrave, but it's there and it's filled with sculpture. And you know, I've never thought until right now about, I wonder what the sculpture tells in sort of a story. I bet it does. And look at the ladies inside. I mean, the standing on the porch, they're just, it's so graceful, that silhouette. I don't think they could breathe very well, but it sure is pretty. Inside the children's building was a model kindergarten. And this was a really progressive notion. I mean, the idea that children as young as 5 could sit in a classroom and learn something was, I don't know that we can go so far as to say it was radical. It certainly wasn't a first here, but this was early days for kindergarten, and so as you all know, it was optional for a long time. I mean, I came along when it was just changing from optional to required, and I think that varied from city to city. I grew up in Atlanta, and we were. How many of you all was kindergarten required for, and how many of you got to choose? Let me phrase it differently. How many of you know that when you went to school, you could choose whether to go to kindergarten or not? Okay, so that was quite a few. So it's a relative, the required kindergarten, and now we're looking at pre-K education and how vital that is. So progressive social movement here. Yeah. Okay, right. So, and you turned out okay. Isn't that nice? Didn't he? I mean, I'm assuming.
He's a doctor.
But it was not available in public school? That's really, so it's later than I thought. And I'm sure it varied from place to place as to what the school system felt able to afford to offer. And there's also, you know, you're balancing what's affordable with what people feel is essential. And today we're dealing with how much pre-K education can we require the schools to provide. And it's clear from the evidence that the earlier you start that kind of, the earlier you read to a child, the earlier you start certain kinds of socialization things, the better chance the child has for making a successful life. So this is really progressive. And I think another thing that's Well, it comes later. I'll get to that later if I remember. This is the woman's building, and it's real interesting to me that it's not women's, it's woman's. So it is the woman. And all the women from cities and towns all across Tennessee participated in this. They also were a lot of the push, I think, behind some of the men to get things done, but their names aren't on anything except this. President McKinley and his wife came to the fair. Now, they didn't come for the opening, but for the opening day, there was an electric relay between Nashville and Washington, D.C., and the White House, and McKinley flipped the switch that turned the lights on for the first time the day of the opening. But it was later in the fair, I think in June, but I don't remember the exact date, he and Mrs. McKinley came, and it was a huge deal. And the women had a luncheon for Mrs. McKinley, and there's a picture that, it's not in the slideshow, but I saw one, you know, when I was putting all this together, of the crowds at the door trying to get in to, they weren't invited to the luncheon, that was already set, but they wanted to see and shake hands with Mrs. McKinley, and evidently she was overcome with the heat and the crowd and everything, had to just faint. So this is, just to locate it for you in today's park, this is close to where the Arts Activity Center is, what used to be the Community Center in Centennial Park. They're behind, it's the building between us and McDonald's, if that helps. And there is a monument there now, a marker, that is a granite plinth with a sphere on top of it. It's beautiful, utterly simple, utterly plain, and the inscription says, "That which is round can be no rounder." If anybody ever comes up with what that means, please tell me. We laugh about it all the time because it's like, okay. I just have to go with the idea that it means women were well-rounded. They were capable in all spheres. And that may be.
Yogi Bear. Sounds like Yogi Bear.
It does. Deja vu all over again. Yeah. Oh. So the women were prominent in the execution of the exposition and making it happen, and they famous women came to the fair. One was Susan B. Anthony. We really tried to find out whether she had spoken officially at the fair, and can't find any evidence for that. So we know she visited. We don't think she gave a speech. And there are some things that were considered too divisive, too politically sensitive to have a building or something, and one of them was women's suffrage. Think about the timing and how long it took was it Susan B. Anthony who started agitating for women's suffrage before the Civil War, 1840s, and it took until 1920. Before it was ratified, the amendment. Anyway, so that was considered a political football, a hot potato, and so women's suffrage was alluded to in various exhibitions, but didn't have its own big presence there, which is probably why she didn't speak. The History Building is a little small building, and you'll see pictures later. This is one besides the Parthenon that stayed for a while after the exposition was over. And I'm not quite sure why. I presume maybe this held the precursor to the State Museum. I don't really know, and I never thought of that until this moment. If I can remember long enough, I'll ask. It was compared to many of the other buildings, it was small, but it would have had a very great importance to talk about what had happened in our state up to this point. Oh, wow, what a good question. They look like it. But people didn't know about those windows at this time. Those windows are late 20th century discovery, like the 90s or the 90s. early 90s, because I was there in 94, but they were newly discovered then. So they do look like that, and that position on the wall and the squareness of them repeats that, even though they didn't know it. The Negro building was across Lake Watauga, almost directly from the Parthenon, and it's sort of a Spanish Revival style. There was a big to-do about whether, how much the African Americans would participate in what capacity and whether they would participate at all, because this was the decade that the Jim Crow laws were being enacted. So life for African Americans was not getting better at this point. I mean, in some ways it was, but just because life in general was better for people. There was progress with electricity and streetcars and all that sort of stuff. But for this group of former slaves, this was a time when things were going backwards. And yet, they wanted to show off the progress they had made as a people, both while they were slaves and certainly since. So W.E.B. Du Bois, who was an articulate and very vocal speaker against the Jim Crows and for full participation in the life of the country, objected to a presence like this at the fair because there were laws being enacted that were anti-progress for the African Americans. Then there were people like Booker T. Washington, who said, "Show them what we've done. Show them what we can do. We have an opportunity to shine a good spotlight on us. Let's do it." In the end, the faction that he was the spokesperson for won that debate, and so they did have a large presence at the fair. And as far as my reading can tell me, the only place where there was segregation was in the restaurants. So the African Americans had full access to everything else, as far as I've been able to tell. And the restaurant in the Negro building was hugely popular with everybody. And that's interesting to me. If it was segregated in the other restaurants, then they couldn't go. But I think everybody could come. Not sure about that, now that I've said it. Anyway, it was a lovely building. And big. The agriculture building, and I put a picture here on the right of a sort of typical display. These are grasses of Tennessee. And I mean, how many grasses are there? How many? I don't know, but it looks like a lot. And they've made it into a thing, a sculpture, an object. Other states participated, so Alabama, Illinois, Ohio, New York, and Texas. Anybody surprised that that's the Texas building? So right now, we just have the Alabama, Illinois, and Texas, but there were other states that participated. And it was a way to say, we support Tennessee, come look at us. And this is what we can do and do. There were fraternal philanthropic organizations, men's, that had their own buildings there. So the Woodmen of the World was one. Here we have the Maccabees. I know nothing about them except the biblical Maccabees that appear in the intertestamental period. I guess their name for that, but their little building is like a beehive. They seem very confused. The Redmen, whose sort of wigwamish thing there, is on the right, and the Knights of Pythias. Now, this is one that some of you might, I have no idea who was a Knight of Pythias or exactly what they did. All of these were secret, kind of like the Masons, only not nearly as extensive or historically long-lived. And they did, like the Lions and the Rotary, they had charities, they did good things, but they were mostly about getting together. And this little building, which really is tiny, it's house-sized, one of the knights of Pythias was a youngish man, and he was courting a young lady. So at the end of the fair, he thought this was just a really beautiful building, and he had some property out near Franklin. So he had this dismantled piece by piece and reassembled on his property on Highway 96, and then she turned him down. And I don't know whether it was him or the fact she didn't want to live out there, but it still exists. And I believe that it is, if you're going south on 65 and get off on 96, I think it's not between I-65 and Franklin, but between...
It's just short of West Haven.
Okay.
For
those of you who know where West Haven is, there you go. And it's been added on to, and the people that, it's recently been sold within the last 2 years, and the people that owned it before that did a huge amount of restoration, and I was fortunate enough to be able to tour it. It's a lovely thing, really pretty. And there are, you can't see it in this picture, but there are windows here that are operated from a pulley system in the wall. But that's glass, that dome, and I was there in the summer. It's kind of hot. It's the dining room.
That appears to be a Star of David on the porch behind the car.
Well, it does, doesn't it? And then there's something that matches it but is different over there on the left. So she's talking about this, and I don't know what that is, and I don't know of any connection unless maybe they accepted all religious persuasions, which is kind of unusual. I don't know. It's worth some, yeah, here's a research paper. If somebody wants to research the Knights of Pythias and tell us. My favorite one, I have never seen their building, and I'm not actually positive they had one, but they were present at the fair, the Concatenated Order of the Hoo-Hoo. They're listed in the book, I can tell you. The Concatenated Order of the Hoo-Hoo. Don't you want to know what they did? I mean, I just think that is marvelous. Over the narrowest part of Lake Watauga was a copy of Venice's Rialto Bridge. Just like its original, it was lined with shops, so people could buy souvenirs. And one of the things that I will want you to look at when we do the tour of the Parthenon in 2 weeks is we've got some just gorgeous souvenirs on exhibit, and I think about the plastic that we buy and t-shirts and stuff, and those are our souvenirs, ball caps, snow globes. Those are not so bad, but and we sell them at the Parthenon store. But they were buying sterling silver spoons and bronze medallions and ruby flash glass. And some of you may have seen these antique fairs have them. You'd pick a clear glass shape that you liked, and you'd buy that, and the vendor would turn it upside down into some liquid red. Now, sometimes it was a stain. Sometimes it was actually molten red glass. And then it would dry, and he would engrave whatever you wanted on it. Always on part of it would be either 1897 or Tennessee Centennial or something like that, and then you could have Lula or Irvin or Mother or, you know, whatever. And we've got several of those that people have given us or that we've bought or that are on loan. Just recently someone gave us a decanter, which we don't have out yet, but it's, you know, it's big. So people took home really beautiful things. There were little shell ornaments, and some of them are gigaws, then you just think they're going to gather dust, but beautiful ones and well made. So I'm presuming that the Rialto is one of the places you could shop for goodies like that. Also from Venice were gondolas with their gondoliers, and for 10 cents a ride you could get the gondolier to take you around Lake Watauga, and he would even sing to your sweetheart. But there were other kinds. There were little paddle boats, too. There were various kinds of water vehicles that would take you around the lake. Mostly, I think those were just to be on the water, be refreshed, and see everything from the water. But the island that, there are two islands out in the middle of Lake Watauga, and this is the larger of the two. This kind of got trees on it, and it was the Blue Grotto. And I don't know what they did there. There was some entertainment. So right now we are seeing, here's a gondola that's moored there, and these are young women in costume creating a tableau. And I suppose that after they finished their tableau, they would go in and there would be some theatrical something inside the Blue Grotto. We don't have any pictures from inside, so I really don't know. But you know, this. Remember the musical, the Music Man? That's actually maybe a little later. I think that takes place in 19-aught something. But this was an era when one of the entertainments, and it goes even earlier than this, you know, you'd draw a curtain and suddenly there would be Rebecca at the well and who's it's finding her or watering the camels, or it would be a Grecian urn. And there would be three or four all women garbed in vaguely classical dress, and that would... tableau vivant is what they were called. So this is evidently a tableau vivant. Entertainment, as I said earlier, was one of the features. You were supposed to be educated, but you were supposed to have a really good time while you did that. So this is, I don't know if you can see him, Orion is a high wire walker. He's going, this is one platform, and he's midway. And all these people are just sitting down there with mouths hanging open. He was, and this is true of many of the midway things to do and see, they were carny people, and they would, after this fair, would pack up and go to another one somewhere. So most of these were not local or even from this area of the country. They were people who traveled, like circus people, acrobats and stuff, and Orion was one of those for sure. And this is that picture we saw a minute ago. Here are gondolas pulled up. This is the edge of the Commerce Building. This is the edge of the Knights of Pythias, the Parthenon, and the Pyramid are over here. This is that little landing stage that, oh, if you grew up here, you remember the paddle boats on Lake Watauga. And that area dates from the centennial. I mean, that little jut out into the water where the shed was that you rented the paddle boats has been a boat rental place since the fair, I guess. I mean, I don't think, maybe it's where you picked up the boats for the fair. Certainly they're docking here and letting people on and off. And this is all midway area. So the Moorish Palace, not sure what went on in the Moorish Palace, but it was a place of entertainment that was vaguely Arab. And Edison, this is a bad slide, but this is Edison's Mirage. And you could go in and see little one-minute movies or 30-second movies, and there were four or five of those, and you'd sit and watch. And I mean, think about that. This is 1897. Most of these people had never seen a moving picture. It was new stuff, cutting edge, and was very popular. The streets of Cairo. This is part of what I mean about carny people. The big attraction here were camel rides for 10 cents a piece. They had three camels. They were named Ali Baba, Yankee Doodle Dandy, and Nancy Hanks. I don't know. Poor Nancy. Maybe she was the most attractive camel. Nancy Hanks was the name of Abe Lincoln's mother. So I'm not sure if this was a direct reference to her. Or I also know that in my childhood there was a train engine called the Nancy Hanks. And so since railroads had a lot to do with this, I've never been sure what the tie-in to Nancy Hanks was. But... she was a camel. So they had vaguely Egyptian music, and you could walk. I mean, this was a thing that you entered in, and it was a one street long. There was I don't think I put everything in here, but there was a Chinese village. Now, this one, there was also a South American Cuban, it was called the Cuban Village, but it had dancers and I think it was a little bit hoochie-coochie. I mean, I remember going to the Southeastern Fair when I was a child. Mom and Dad would only take us once or twice, but, oh, the memories are so vivid. It always happened in September. It always smelled like peanuts and popcorn and cotton candy, and there would always be these places with barkers standing outside saying, come on in, come and see the hoochie-coochie. She crawls on her belly like a reptile. Well, they weren't actually saying that, but and I was fascinated. I wanted to go inside. Mother yanked me along. Don't even look. So this is a carnival kind of thing, and I don't want to malign the Cuban village from 1897, but you look at the pictures, and there's one you'll see on our tour, and you think, okay, like can-can dancers, probably something not too risque, but a little demi-monde. So... Yeah, right. So anybody with a scoop neck and short sleeves and little, well, it's pretty risque. Anyway, there was a Chinese village, and this was a little different. Once again, you could walk in, and there had been people, the proprietor of this, I don't even know what to call it, attraction, had brought over people, families from China. And so they really sort of lived there during the fair. And what I have read or been told by people who've been doing research on this is that after the fair, this guy kind of said, well, you're on your own, and abandoned them. It was not a pretty picture. So there were people, you know, making big money here who were variously good citizens and not. I mean, I'm not, certainly not trying to tar everybody with that brush, but some were not very kind. This is the reason I want a time machine. This is called Shoot the Chutes, and it is a water ride predating the log rides at Six Flags, and you would go up this little cog railway. I think I stretched this a little bit, and it looks a little flatter than it. It's pretty high up. You'd go up on this little ratchet thing, transfer to a boat, and come whooshing down like this. They felt it necessary to post a little sign, which I've seen in another picture. This water is only 30 inches deep. Now, of course, you can drown in 2 inches, so I'm not sure what that... But it meant that you weren't in deadly danger. But it must have been pretty scary, kind of like roller coaster rides, because when they drained the lake at the end to dismantle it, they found several sets of false teeth. I do believe that if I'd had false teeth and lost them, I'd have sent a diver down. I mean, good grief. Paris had its Eiffel Tower. St. Louis, Chicago had the Ferris wheel, and Nashville had the giant seesaw. The folks about the Tennessee Fair thought this was gonna last. This was the coming attraction. That Ferris wheel. It looks like an Erector set, if you remember those. Do they still have those? I don't even know. There's a better version of this picture that we will see. At the Parthenon, but these are the people down here, and there's a car on either end. It holds about 20 and goes 240 feet in the air. Now, this is pre-Wright Brothers, pre-flight. Think about what it would have been like to go up and see not only the whole exposition spread out before you, but the whole city. My stars and garters, you could see... I think, that is the state capitol, hazy in the distance there. And I think it would have just been so exciting and so scary. Oh, my goodness. It would have taken a great deal of courage to go up in that thing. And this is a view of the fair from the seesaw. So here's the Parthenon. This is the cupola of the Commerce Building. This is the Hygiene and Education Building, the Memphis Pyramid, the Negro Building. That's maybe the Machinery Hall. I can't remember. Here's the Blue Grotto and the other island out there. the little landing stage. I think that's either the Alabama building or the Redmond building. There's the Rialto Bridge. So, and there's the state capitol. I think that's all you can see right now. Anyway. I should know the answer to that off the top of my head, and I don't. But when we get through, come up here and look at this. In fact, I may just get it in a minute, pass it around. Restaurants, I've already talked a little bit about. There were several. The Lion Garden, the Casino, Old Vienna. And they weren't all Gerst family, although I think the Gersts had a presence in more than one. And having a picnic. I mean, look, you know what a Nashville summer's like. Just up to here, down to here, and they look like they're having a good time. Actually, honestly, I'm sure they were. You do not miss what you've never had. They'd never had air conditioning. So this was a pleasure. This was, there were some trees. It was fun. There were fans. Oh, there were ice water fountains at various places where they were packed with ice so that the water coming up out of them would be cool. And one of the fights about being a city that allowed alcohol was the Women's Christian Temperance Union, and that was another social movement. Those were almost all women, at least at the beginning, who saw and worried about women and families who starved or were beat up because their husbands would get their paycheck at the end of the week and go spend it in the saloon before coming home. And so the idea of prohibition, which backfired tremendously when it became national law, was prompted. I mean, it was a social reform movement to try and protect women and children from the awful effects of unrestrained alcohol. I don't think these folks have alcohol. Well, I was going to tell you that John Thomas was so smart about marketing, and he made every day of the fair dedicated to some group or person, or sometimes several groups. So there was Presbyterian Day, there was Nashville Day, there was Sons of the Confederate Veterans Day, there was John Thomas Day. There was, and so all the people that were either part of that group or supported that person would come on that day. He also had seen in Atlanta at the Cotton States Exposition this idea of a season pass, and he thought, you know, that's really good. You get the money on the front end, and they may or may not use all the little tickets. But he also saw that they were shared among friends and family, and he thought, not on my watch. So he made, this is 1897, he made them season passes photo ID. And I just think that's so forward thinking. And so this grim looking lady, I don't know if she was entertained or not, but she didn't use all her tickets, clearly. And there were fireworks almost every night. And this is another attraction. This is something that brought people to the fair because it's unusual. And, you know, I remember as a child being so excited when I saw searchlights because that meant there was a movie premiere or some star or there was some event. Nowadays it's kind of ho-hum. But fireworks were even huger than they are now. And here we come to the... we're just trying to see if we, I think we'll stop here and do we might do a little interim. This is, you see that the all the other buildings have been torn down. And the Parthenon stands in pretty much lonely splendor. Now, here's the little history building. And look at that snow. We don't have those much anymore. But you can see where it's located. And this, we know, was post- at least 1909, because the statue of John Thomas, which still exists, is already in place. So we know the date when that was put in place. Anything with that statue in it, we know is 1909 or later. And this is Lily Lake, which is now the Sunken Garden. But that little bridge and the little outcropping of rock still exist. And there is some possibility that it will be restored to a lake as part of the master plan. And the function of the sunken garden, which is seen of so many weddings nowadays, will be maybe around the lake with water as a backdrop. It could be very beautiful. And this is an aerial view. I think it's really amazing to look at. We think of the park as so static unless there's something major like the daylighting of Cockrell Spring or something like that, the redoing of the Parthenon's parking lot. But it has changed over the years. This maze is gone. Look at all this formal planting in the Great Lawn. This pretty stuff here, right around the John Thomas statue, is a sort of design of boxwoods. The lake edge, it looks more like this now than it did when I first started to work at the Parthenon. It was very hard-edged, and trees weren't leaning over. And so the roads within the park have changed and will change again. It's just an interesting thing to see something where you think you know it's always been the same, and you look and you say, oh, well, no, it hasn't always been the same. And this one is, I think, prior to 1909, and you can see how badly the Parthenon's already deteriorated. I mean, the steps are in bad shape. It looks pretty crumbly up here. So already it was in need of some work or a decision. We tear it down and forget it, or we make it right. Ivy has grown up on the columns. This is looking at the building from the north side, where our parking lot is today. And the pediment figures have already been removed. So clearly they were falling apart and were dangerous. This shot is taken from either 29th, or maybe 30th or 31st. I'm not sure it's as high up as 31st, but looking toward, here's the Tower of Kirkland Hall, Vanderbilt, and the little history building is still there. So I'm maybe 1910 or 11 or something like that. It's always been a site for pageants and advertising. This guy had he was advertising a new wheel for the car that had the springs in the spokes of the wheel. I don't know if the car body had any springs or not. It did not take off. But people come, I mean, we have a whole calendar from a trucking company where their trucks have been parked in front of the Parthenon, and each month one truck is Mr. May or Ms. June. These are little satyrs from the Mysteries of Thanatos. There were two or three big pageants in the teens prior, or just at the beginning of World War I. One was called The Mysteries of Thanatos, and one was called The Fire Regained. I guess they were just two. And I wish I had in digital format my favorite picture, and I can't remember now which one it was from, but there was a big center out on the lawn, sort of formation, like a rock formation, and with women in vaguely Grecian costumes, long streaming hair, sort of a tableau vivant. Doves have just been released. You see a sheep or two, and coming around the bend are chariots. There was a chariot race on the Great Lawn in 1914. It must have just been, want to go with me when I get the time machine? So we'll stop here because we're going to get into the rebuilding. And so next week we're going to talk about the rebuilding of the Parthenon, the making it permanent, and the making of Athena, and then the gilding of Athena. Maybe a little bit about the master plan, but probably not. And let me just show you. I don't know. Maybe I just need to pass this around. Because this gives you an idea of where things were. I mean, we've seen most of these things, but to get a sense of how they fit